Welcome to the Seventh Row Podcast. I am Ola Smith, one of the hosts of this podcast and the executive editor of Seventh Row. Seventh Row is a non-profit online film criticism publication and publishing house dedicated to helping viewers engage in political conversations through the lens of cinema. We are invested in how film can be a catalyst to help people understand and think about social structures and social change. On today's episode, we will be discussing Sarah Polley's acclaimed new film, Women Talking, which is adapted from a novel by Canadian author Miriam Taves. The film stars Claire Foy, Jessie Buckley, Rooney Mara, Ben Whishaw, and more in a tale of a group of Mennonite women debating whether they should stay in their community to try to reform the men who have committed multiple acts of rape, or if they should leave to find a new way of living for themselves. This film was the runner-up for the TIFF People's Choice Awards. It is a big Oscar contender and it's been largely critically acclaimed, but we don't agree. If you told us at the beginning of the year that we'd be so down on a Sarah Polley film, I think both Alex and I would have been very surprised. We are such big fans that we've even done podcast episodes on two of her three previous features, Take This Waltz and Stories We Tell, and I'll link those for you in the show notes for this episode. Not only that, we pretty much love most of the actors in this film. So we were surprised when we found that the film was kind of insulting in the way it attempts to engage in feminist discourse. It's all too simplistic, didactic, and non-specific in our eyes. And in this episode, we dig into why, and why all of that bothers us so much. Our bonus episodes, like this one, are usually members only, but we wanted to offer this up as a free example of the kind of content you'll get if you become a member. If you want access to our other bonus episodes, you can become a member at seventh-row.com/join. That will also be in the show notes. The voices you'll hear in this episode are me, hello, my co-host Alex Heaney, the editor-in-chief of Seventh Row, and our special guest, Angelo Moretta, who we will introduce in a bit more detail at the start of the recording. I hope you enjoy the episode.
We are happy to welcome a very special guest today, Dr. Angelo Moretta, who has a PhD in CanLit from the University of Toronto, which I have interpreted, based on our discussions, as meaning he has met every single author in Canadian literature. And I do know he has met Taves. Every time I mention a Canadian lit author to him, he tells me he knows them. Angelo teaches in the Department of English at Humber College and is a freelance critic for CinemaScope magazine and Film Freak Central. He has also written essays in a couple of our books. He has great essays on Wendy and Lucy in our Kelly Reichardt book, Roads to Nowhere, and a great essay on the female gaze in art and in the film Portrait on a Lady. There we go. By Celine Sciamma in her book Portraits of Resistance. Sorry, Angelo, please just say hello so people can hear your voice before I talk over you some more.
Hello. Nice to be here again.
When I invited Angelo to come on the podcast, we did have a discussion about how we have invited a man to our Women Talking podcast.
That is very representative of the film.
Exactly. Because the film also kind of prioritizes a male perspective. So he's asked us to remind him that he's taking the notes, the minutes, and... you know, if you find that he's making really good points, that you want to listen to him rather than us, that is perhaps consistent with the film itself.
He is our Ben Whishaw.
You're right. I will do as he does in the movie and say, but what I have to say isn't important here.
And we will say not all men in return.
Thank you.
There we go. So why are we talking about Women Talking today?
Well, because everyone's talking about it.
Oh. I feel like we all came out of it really angry and we needed to unleash those feelings. I saw it first and then I was like really hoping Angelo could see it so I could bitch about it with him. And then Orla, you were like, I mean, it can't be as bad as they said.
Well, because we all, well, I mean, I certainly, you and I love Sarah Polley.
Yes.
And
we loved all of her other films. I haven't seen her TV show Alias Grace, but I've loved her first three feature films.
And I thought, Alex must be having a bad day. And it can't be this bad. I remember hearing about this film, you know, over a year ago now, probably, and thinking, wow, this is just like a perfect cast for me.
Yeah.
Perfect cast and director pairing. I'm so excited. Absolutely brilliant. Cast full of these great actresses, plus Ben Whishaw is the only man, which is, you know,
the way brilliant. The world should be.
Exactly. And when you said it was bad and got increasingly angry about the ways in which it was bad, I was kind of in a phase of denial until I heard more and more people that I trust saying the same thing. And I was like, okay, this can't just be Alex having a bad day. I've got to accept that I might not like this film. But I went in, you know, still hoping to get something from it. And I came out quite angry, just as you did. So there you go.
My recollection was once you saw it, you were like, yeah, we have to do a podcast about this. We got it. We have to, like, get rid of this pent-up anger. Much like Promising Young Woman, where it was like I lived with that with the hatred of that film for 6-8 months or more.
I mean, you have said in our Google Doc, like, is it this year's Nomadland? And I think maybe in like the vibe of the filmmaking, it might be more of a speed with that film. But I do think it's also kind of this year's Promising Young Woman in terms of the way that like people are falling over themselves to talk about it as this feminist masterpiece, but it's really just kind of like an Oscar baity shallow film in my eyes. Had any of us read the book before they saw the film, or was this a retroactive situation?
I had not read the book before the film because I'm very bad at reading Canlit, because I was traumatized in high school by reading the very worst of Canlit and didn't realize there was good Canlit. I think Angelo was traumatized by his PhD in Canlit.
Yeah, I hadn't read it because it sort of came out at the time when I stopped reading Canadian literature, because I had just finished a PhD and I just could not look at another emission from the Canlit industry. And so I hadn't read it.
Emission!
what better word than emission? Vaguely gaseous.
But my impression is that it's a sort of relatively recent book, and that it was like quite acclaimed within Canlit.
Yeah, I mean, she was the author was kind of a big deal in Canlit, and several of her books have been adapted into movies, which I have. Well, she wrote the book All My Puny Sorrows, and we know that film sucked.
Yeah. I didn't realize she wrote that.
Yeah. I think she wrote another book, I want to say Silent Night, that was adapted into a film, but I don't know anything about that.
She starred in the Carlos Regattas movie, Silent Light, which is not hers, actually. Like,
she was, okay.
I don't know if you know the story of how she was cast in it, but it's pretty funny. He was walking, I think he was just in a bookstore, and he just happened to be flipping through book covers and saw her photo on the jacket cover and then read that she was a Mennonite. I was like, oh my God, I want to make a movie about a Mennonite community in Mexico. And so he basically cast her from the jacket cover photo of her. And she hadn't acted before that.
That's hilarious.
Look, Steven Soderbergh classed Claire Foy in Unsane from her like Emmy's acceptance speech for The Crown. Yeah. He was like, she seems cool. I'm going to put her in my movie. He hadn't seen The Crown or anything she'd done. So
brilliant.
Interesting.
Yeah. And speaking of Nomadland, because Frances McDormand bought up the rights to the book Women Talking, I think, pretty fast, maybe even before it was published. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
She just heard that it was called Women Talking. She thought that would be good for my production company.
And then Sarah Polley had read the book after it came out, and she emailed her agent, was like, can I adapt this? And it turns out they share an agent. And Frances McDormand and her producing partners were like, we'd really love to ask Sarah Polley to do this. So there you go. They fell in love over this book. Okay, well, so what the hell is this thing about? Now that we've trashed it, well, we're just getting started. The film is set in a Mennonite community populated primarily with British and or Irish actors doing bad American accents, or Canadian actors in their own Canadian accent. So we don't know where it is. Almost every woman in the community has been drugged and raped by men in the community, including young girls and teenagers. Many of them repeatedly over like months and months, possibly years in the movie. I'm not sure. So the women decide to hold a vote to determine if, as a group, they want to do nothing, leave, or stay and fight. And three generations of women from two families are chosen to represent the community to have a discussion about what they should do and make the final decision based on a vote between themselves. So they have a couple days to do this, and they gather in a barn to discuss. It's an ensemble film, so the de facto leader of this discussion is the free-thinking Ona, played by Rooney Mara, who is pregnant as a result of a rape but refuses to marry. She regularly butts heads with Marika, played by Jesse Buckley, who is married to an abusive husband and has two children, at least one of whom was also a victim of these crimes, and she is kind of afraid to do anything because she's already traumatized. And then there's the fiery Salome, played by Claire Foy, who is extremely angry and is also caring for her very young daughter, like 3, 5 maybe, she can carry her, who got an STD as a result of her rape. And Salome had to walk really far, like 12 kilometers or something, to secretly get her antibiotics because the community leader refused to get them for her. So they're joined by two teenagers from their family who are also victims, and the two matriarchs of the family, Agata, played by Judith Ivy, and Greta, played by the great Sheila McCarthy, who is a big deal in Canada.
Who's in Patricia Rosemary's first film.
Right.
Yeah, and like tons. She's in like everything. And it's Stratford and yeah. So Ona invites the male school teacher, August, who is also her childhood friend. And August is played by Ben Whishaw, and he is there to take the minutes of the meeting.
But his opinion doesn't matter.
Well, that's what they keep telling him.
And as he reminds them a few times as well.
Yes, because sometimes they do ask him because he's educated, they think.
The thing about it is that it's... I mean, we've used the phrase like, oh, we were so offended by the film so far. And I think it's the things that would make it quote-unquote offensive are subtler in the ways that it like fucks up something that is ultimately good intentioned. It's not like promising young woman levels of abrasive. It's trying to provide like a thoughtful discourse on... I don't know, I hate it when people say it's about like the Me Too era or whatever, but it's definitely like, you know, bouncing off of increased discussions about like rape culture and feminism, especially like in film, and talking about whether it's like their whole thing is discussing whether to stay and try to like improve the community of men and teach the young boys to be better, or to leave for self-preservation and to leave their homes. And it's this idea of, do we remove ourselves for safety, or do we try to improve things from within? And I think that the film has been really widely beloved in the film festival Oscar season circuit. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because it is very like explicitly about ideas of feminism and rape culture. And
these Mennonite women seem to be very conversant in the Twitter vocabulary. Yes. Around the Me Too era.
Well, but that's where the problems with the film really arise, is because the film is like a mouthpiece for all of these ideas.
Yeah.
And every character represents a different side, or like a different way that you could think about these things. But that's the very problem, that they aren't characters and they are like illiterate women who are cut off from wider society. They don't have an internet connection, and yet the way they speak is in the language of like discussions about feminism that you might find on the internet, like very, very contemporary discoursey language. Like there is a moment in the film where the phrase "not all men" is used.
Yeah.
And it's very grating. It's also depicting these women who have like gone through like a kind of unbelievable trauma, like extended trauma over possibly years.
Yeah.
And it never feels like a film with characters who have like been through trauma. It feels like a film where these characters are acting as mouthpieces for various ideas and are talking them through. But I never got the sense of like how these people were like actually processing this very real thing that happened to them. And in that way, it's almost kind of flippant about how it talks about this story, which is actually based on a true story. And it feels very disconnected from like the reality of like being a Mennonite woman within this insular community. So I just found it to be such like a pandering way to talk about these ideas that feels disconnected from like actual characters and feels like it's just playing to like an Oscar voter crowd who want to vote for something that is very explicitly quote unquote progressive.
Yeah, it also doesn't ask the audience to think. It just kind of tells them, hey, patriarchy's pretty bad. And like something we talked about with our associate editor right after he finished his PhD, Brett Party, we did a bonus episode where we talked to him about like empathy in film and how didactic films don't really work to create empathy. And this film really does not ask you to have independent thought and does not create characters who are, I mean, they're not, as you said, they're not characters, they're mouthpieces. I know nothing about them outside of the opinion that they are there, they exist to share, pretty much.
It feels like every character is meant to kind of cover every discursive base for us. And like, to sort of piggyback on what everybody's saying, like, I think this focus on the discursive pyrotechnics of like, this person who feels this versus this person who feels this in the room really does, as Orla was saying, kind of obfuscate the actual situation that they're in and what's actually happened to them, right? Like there are immediate reasons for them to meet right now, right? They're coming up with alternative forms of policing because they can't go to the police because the police are useless. Alternative forms of justice because they have not been raised to think about these things and to have any say in justice. There's an immediacy of like protecting themselves, protecting their children, right? Like they're actual immediate things they have to deal with. And I think there's something about the way the movie and the book, right? Like this is fundamental to the text of Women Talking. The way it kind of like gestures to these larger discourses that we reading it know about kind of takes away from the specifics. And like it comes out in the anachronistic language, as you pointed out, not just in the not all men moment, which is funny in the movie, not on purpose, I think, but like the way that they talk about violence and harm to me, like the use of those terms. I mean, maybe this is all in the novel. It's because August is the transcriber of the conversations, right? So maybe August has been hanging out in some social justice forums and he has this language, but it's not clear to me why they in this community, when they have not been educated in those worlds and grown up in those worlds, why they kind of have the social justice language to kind of plug what's happened to them into that wider world. It would be more interesting if they independently came at those values without knowing the language, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Mm.
Even in the book, there are a few references where August is like, they didn't actually say this word, but mm-hmm, I think that's the word that they mean. And so he states that. And the thing that we don't get in the film, but we're told in the book, is that they all, like, the book is set in a Bolivian Mennonite colony called the Manitoba Colony, which is Well, it's theoretically set there. I don't know if it's really fair to say that. That's the, like, original true story that was the inspiration for the book. And so it keeps, like, two or three details of what that place is in the book. And one of those details is that the women don't speak. Well, everybody in the colony speaks a form of Low German called Plauditsch. That nobody, it's like basically a dead language everywhere else. And the women don't know how to speak English. And for some reason, August is writing the meeting notes in English. So he is translating on the go into English what they say. So I don't know how much of this is intended by Taves to read into, but there is certainly like some broken telephone and liberties taken with whatever they're saying when August takes those notes.
Yeah.
Two like phrases or individual words I noted down when I was watching it were like the use of the word entitled felt very like contemporary discoursey, and also at one point I think it's Sheila McCarthy's character who very confidently like labels the men as rapists, which of course they are, but it feels almost like there would be more of like a reluctance to use that word as accurate it is as it is. And but I think in general just the confidence with which they have the words to articulate like the theory behind how they're feeling and how like their opinions on the situation, the fact that they don't sort of seem to be like struggling to form a conclusion about how they feel towards a situation, but they seem to arrive at the film from its opening with like very fully formed ideas, just feels like it feels untrue, and it feels very dramatically unsatisfying for a film set in this situation. And it just, and it feels so like not at all revealing of like how people actually think through these ideas. I think one of the like benefits of setting this film in this Mennonite community would be that, as we've said, like you get to watch how people form opinions about their situation without necessarily having the language to do so. So it just ends up feeling like a massive missed opportunity, and very frustrating that this film is like the front runner to win the best screenplay award at the Oscars right now.
Sorry.
The screenplay is just a mess.
It could be worse. Like Empire of Light could be the number one front runner. Would be worse.
Yes, it could be The Whale.
Oh, right. There you go. It could be much worse.
Yes, it could be much worse. But it's still pretty bad.
And I think a lot of what we're sort of reacting to is, like, some of that is a problem with the text, and it's not translated gracefully into the film. Like, Ona, I think, is the character who gets a lot of those kinds of discoursey conversations in the novel. And Ona just knows exactly as much as she needs to know in any given situation, right? There are certain things she doesn't know because she's not literate. She doesn't know what a comma is, but she can quote Virgil, right? Because she was taught Virgil as a child by August's mother. And Ona is the one, if I'm not mistaken, it's certainly in the text, but I forget if she's also the one who says the not all men passage in the film. But in the novel, it's particularly, yes, like, I think it's the same passage. She says, perhaps not all men per se, but a pernicious ideology that has been allowed to take hold of men's hearts and minds, right? Like, Ona has independently defined patriarchy, right? And, like, no, she's, through her own inclinations, touched on, you know, patriarchal violence. And, like, I don't think it's impossible that she would. It's just the way that she articulates ideology to me that rings as phony, right? And it's like, it feels as if she is an authorial stand-in when she needs to be, and then she's like just independently smart but illiterate when she doesn't need to be.
And the film kind of can like write this off a little bit with, like, it has a title card at the beginning that says what follows is an act of female imagination, which is like, well, which I suppose can seem like, oh, well, you know, this isn't, like, exactly how it would have gone down, but, like, imagine if they could have conversations like this. But it's like, well, what's the use in seeing a conversation like this that is, like, that we're so used to already and that is, like, so easy to digest, mm-hmm. I think?
Well, I mean, I actually think that that title card is one of the prime examples of where the adaptation loses context, which is, I mean, we'll talk about how that's an overwhelming problem with the film and possibly a Sarah Polley thing more generally. But in the book, where this, because when I saw the film, I saw that and I laughed. I was like, this is like white feminism 101. And I think I joked that, like, the film is basically Sarah Polley's Twitter account in film form. You know, take at, if you like her Twitter account, you'll like the film. But in the book, there's actually some context to this language. So in the preface, Miriam Taves tells us that the inspiration for the book came from this Bolivian Mennonite community where over the course of 3 years, like, hundreds of women and girls were raped, and the men of the community basically claimed that that it wasn't rapes, that this was wild female imagination, that these things happened. And in real life, the women didn't actually choose to leave the colony. So then Taves is like, okay, so I'm going to write a book where I try and reclaim that language and reshape this narrative and say, this book is a work of female imagination by saying, like, the rapes weren't female imagination, but imagining a better world is female imagination. And so then it doesn't just seem like this weird, like, new agey feminist language coming out of nowhere. Like, there's mm-hmm. context in the book, but in the film, it's like, why was that title card necessary? And you have no idea where it's coming from.
But so you're saying that she, that in reality they stayed.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I feel about that, because I sort of feel like, you know, instead now we have a book that is like, what if they did what I think they should have done, rather than trying to understand why they did what they actually did.
I think that's maybe one of the ways in which Taves, as the teller of this story, is kind of, you know, inherently problematic, in the sense that Taves is someone who left yeah. the Mennonite community and, you know, did go away and become a cosmopolitan figure and became very well educated and wrote novels. And it is very much, you know, writing about that community as someone who has left it. And so that's something that sort of, you know, pings me as I'm watching and thinking about the way that we have an author who did leave that community thinking about this utopian potential if others did what she did. And it just sort of creates a kind of metatextual ickiness that hangs over it.
Yeah. And she left it 35 years ago, because when the book came out, there was this interview with her in the New York Times. And they also talked to some Mennonites to find out, like, did they like this book? Did they think it was terrible? And they didn't talk to a lot of, like, I don't know how much to take what the people they've quoted are as, like, how much to take them as a grain of salt or not, because they don't really give us enough, like, it basically seems like they kind of talked to two random Mennonites. But one of them was at least a senior writer at the bi-monthly magazine Canadian Mennonite. And he said, Will Braun, who's a farmer, said that he likes her writing, but, you know, she's not an authority on Mennonites, local Mennonites, or for that matter, ones living far away in Bolivia. And he says she's just too far removed at this point.
And for what it's worth, A Complicated Kindness, which was kind of the first of her novels that really sort of took off. I mean, I don't know if it was the first that took off, but it really got her mainstream success, I would say. That one is also really, that one narratively hinges upon the protagonist's decision to either stay within or leave her Mennonite community. And it's very much interested in, like, what keeps people in communities like this and what enables them to leave and what do we need to do to allow people to see that they can have a life outside of it. So from Taves' perspective, I think it's sort of a piece with other texts that she's written about that kind of decision-making process. And maybe that's some of the context that sort of gets shorn off in the adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, with Sarah Polley then adapting it, you have another step of removal. And in the film, the community and where it's set and, like, what it's like to live there becomes especially, almost like, intentionally non-specific. Like, I really didn't feel what was, like, in their decision making between leaving and staying, she doesn't really do much to give you a sense of, like, what their lives there are like and what might be tying them there, like how they feel within this community, what they might like about living there, as, like, most people feel in some way like some positive connection to their home, even if they largely dislike it. Like, it really doesn't feel at all lived in.
I mean, it reminded me a lot of, like, there's recently been quite a lot of films about Hasidic Jews and either leaving Hasidic Jewish communities or, I mean, there was one film that was actually shot that was about somebody living in a Hasidic Jewish community and shot with Hasidic Jews who had, like, never seen a movie before. These films are all kind of, like, inherently problematic in one way or another, even if some of them do these things better than, say, Women Talking does. Like, I mean, Disobedience, for example, is written by a woman who grew up as a Hasidic Jew, and then she left at, like, 18, and then the book is kind of about this woman this woman, her father was, like, the rabbi, and he dies, and she goes back home for a week to effectively sit Shiva without a Shiva celebration and contemplate what she's lost by having left the community. But since the author is, like, this community was obviously a bad place, I think even the book doesn't do a great job of telling you that there's anything good about it. Whereas, ironically, the film, which was directed by Sebastian Lelio, who is definitely not Jewish, does a lot more to sort of evoke, like, this, the food and the smells and the community and the sense of place and what's lost with that. And then when you have something like Women Talking, it's a little bit more like, say, Felix and Mira, which is a Canadian film that I like, but, like, it came out in, I want to say, 2015. Like, it was kind of okay at the time, I guess, that a Gentile made this film and he consulted with some ex-Hasidic Jews. But, like, that's also problematic because they're going to, like, they left, right? So, of course, they're going to see I'm not saying they're wrong. It's just that they don't necessarily make an effort to tell you to depict the community in its fullness. I think it did, like, a decent job, but it has pitfalls in it.
And you're missing the perspective there, yeah, of those who chose to stay.
And then there is one movie, oh God, I can't remember the name of it. I'll look it up. But I actually interviewed the director of it, but it was about, like, this is the one that was shot in a Hasidic Jewish community. And then the issue with that movie is it follows a male protagonist, and it's made, like, written in collaboration with the actor who plays him, and it's kind of vaguely based on his life. And it's made by a man, and, like, yeah, he thinks being a Hasidic Jew is, like, more or less pretty great because it's patriarchal. And it's kind of about this guy who loses his wife and now who's going to take care of his kids.
Not him,
of course. And so on the one hand, that film is really, you know, entrenched in and in a good way, like, the community. But it's also extremely biased because it's looking at, like, the person who, I mean, in patriarchy, everybody's hurt by patriarchy in some ways. But ultimately, like, men benefit from patriarchy, at least in some ways, whereas women don't get any benefits really from patriarchy. So anyway, sorry, long tangent, but I just felt like this film feels like of a piece with that. I think a lot of the discourse around this film is kind of the problem with the film is it has no context, no sense of place. You have no idea where these people are, who they are, what their community is. And so it's easy, like, that's great if you want this to be a crucible for a discussion of identifying patriarchy, but ultimately then you're using Mennonites as a prop, and that there seems to be a kind of loss of humanity in there.
But even I feel like the films you just mentioned are, like, in, even if they're doing it in a troubling way, they're intentionally trying to depict a community. And I don't think the film Women Talking really is trying to do that at all. Like, it's using this Mennonite community setting just as, like, you know, some kind of, like, allegory for, like, the wider world of patriarchy, and it ends up feeling kind of weird that it is basically using this entire community that exists that was like a big part of this real story as basically a prop to make some kind of wider metaphor and have characters that don't resemble the people who would actually live in that community.
Yeah, 100%. And the film I was talking about, I couldn't remember the name of, was called Menashe. Came out in 2017.
Yeah, it feels like this is both like its widespread appeal, like the thing that makes it such an obvious Oscar contender, but also its limit in terms of specificity, mm-hmm. in terms of like actually saying something specific to its context, like using this specific oppressive religious context as a general way to comment on abuses that we know about in mainstream cultures. So, you know, it feels very much like that's its appeal, but that's also its limitation, right? Like this is used as a kind of prop to have conversations about how men who commit sex crimes should be punished. Do we believe women inherently? Do we believe them in the specifics? How do we police, or how do we alternatively police sexual assault if we don't believe in carceral structures and systems, right? Like all of those are things that the movie is kind of allowing us to talk about, or it's kind of opening up those conversation points, mm-hmm. but at some point they have to be characters too, right? And they have to actually have specific things that have happened to them, and they have to be living in a specific place, or it's just famous actors that we know instigating, you know, conversations, right? And that's kind of how it feels after a certain point.
Yeah. Well, and those actors are even cast to type, really, mm-hmm. right? Like Claire Foy is playing a character she's played 1,000 times before. She's basically sleepwalking through this role. I mean, she's Claire Foy, so she's not as boring. No, she's not boring, really, more or less, as hard as the screenplay tries to make her that. But, you know, she's playing the, like, I have strong opinions and I'm a strong woman and you better listen to me. And, you know, but she's done that. She did that, like, as Anne Boleyn in Will Fall, and she did that in that terrible Damien Chazelle movie about
First Man.
Space.
First Man.
Yes. Thanks. I'm deliberately not remembering the title. Rooney Mara is kind of like, she often gets cast as this, I mean, it's not like she can't play other things, but she has been typecast before as the sort of like quietly wise person, right? Like that's like not unlike her character in Carol, or like her role in, wow, I can't remember any movie titles today. The David Fincher film about Mark Zuckerberg.
The Social Network. Thank you. I mean, she's only in the first scene of that, basically. But her job in that film is to, like, tell the main character all the things about himself that he doesn't quite understand.
Yeah.
And then to be proven right through the rest of the film. So I think it definitely fits in that pattern.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think Ben Whishaw has really done this particular role before, but the idea of Ben Whishaw playing a gentle soul, which is certainly the film's take on August, which I don't necessarily think is the book's take quite so much. The book, you had good words.
He's more of a windbag in the book. He's more Paddington in the movie. He's more windbag in the book, I would say.
Yeah, and kind of like a wet mop in the book, maybe also.
Yeah, I have as much as I really like this cast, I was surprised by how uninterested I was by almost any performance in it. and there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, like you said, they're kind of doing something that we have seen them do before.
Yeah.
And they're also not playing characters, and as good of an actor as you are, there's only so much you can do with a script like this and the extent to which your character has a personality. But then there's also the weird thing about the accents. And as much as like I think and it's particularly a problem I think with Claire Foy and Jesse Buckley for whatever reason, and I think they're both great actors, but their American accents feel very, very put on. And I think I'd say my favorite performance of the women was Mike maybe, or like of the sort of main characters is maybe Rooney Mara.
Yeah.
And I find her compelling, and she can't necessarily like totally save the very monologue-y monologues, but there is something quite grounded about her in comparison to some of the other characters, because she is, and part of the reason for that is she is speaking in her own accent.
Yeah.
And the fact that Jessie Buckley and Claire Foy are trying very hard with these very put-on accent only like increases the staginess of the monologues that they're delivering. Like, yeah. I think in another context, in another film, they could get away with that. Like, I think, you know, Claire Foy's almost kind of doing a similar accent than she did in Unsane, but like with the heightened genre nature of that film, like, it didn't bother me.
Yeah.
But with this film, when it's just people in a barn talking and the dialogue is already very put on, having such a put on accent only really, really highlights that and makes you feel like what you're seeing is so not real, and so just like actors expressing a screenwriter's own viewpoint, not through any kind of like lived in character. And I was really surprised at the thought, even if I don't like this film, I'm gonna like the performances. And I can't honestly really say that that was the case.
There's also a weird thing that's like about the way that this film is sort of a Canadian film and an American film. And so there's lots of Canadian actors in there, and they're not doing American accents. They're just talking in their Canadian accents. So then Claire Foy and Jessie Buckley particularly stand out because they're doing geographically non-specific American accents, but they seem to be surrounded by Canadians. And like, that's sometimes a thing that happens in David Cronenberg films. And I was thinking about like Jude Law's kind of absurd Toronto accent in Existence. But like, anyway, that movie, kind of the point was the accents were bad. But at least he like tried to fit in, sort of. Whereas in this, it's like, well, we have to do American accents because, like, I don't know, Oscars. But like, they're like, it's, if they're geographically non-specific anyway, and they're not like in a place, just why not just let everyone speak in their own accents, like treat it like Shakespeare, where, you know,
yeah, I mean, if you're going to
not that this script is Shakespeare, oh boy,
if you're going, like, I think the script shouldn't have committed to a complete lack of specificity.
Oh yeah, I don't think so either.
But if you are going to commit to a complete lack of specificity, at least just let them do their own voices.
Yeah.
Because that almost like makes the lack of specificity feel a bit more pointed. And again, I don't think it should be that way, but clearly that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that would have been an easy workaround.
I agree about Rooney Mara, though. I think she's the most grounded, and I don't know. I was reminded of the thing that Cate Blanchett's character says to her in Carol, that she's a strange girl. She seems flung from out of space. I feel like that's kind of the angle she takes here in it. Like, she's playing her almost like,
yes,
various actors have played Jesus in movies, right? She's playing her like Willem Dafoe in Last, yes, Temptation of Christ, or Jim Caviezel, right? That kind of like strange space alien deity, like come from another place, wide-eyed innocent who's kind of like an open receiver for ideas that come to her from places. And it's kind of like it's a very literary character, but I think she kind of gets that and plays those notes really well. And I do think the accent is part of it, the fact that she's able to kind of speak in her own methodical accidental ASMR kind of voice, I think allows her to
yes,
do that really well. Whereas Foy, I think, is like doing Sarah Pauly sometimes. Like, sometimes it feels like she sounds like her. I don't know what Buckley was doing. I feel like she's kind of, it sounds like she's chewing rocks or something when she speaks sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think also the thing about like the wiseness of Rooney Mara's character is that could almost work as a choice if every other character didn't also speak with like a knowledge and wiseness on her level, because it makes almost sense with her character, given that she has the history of like having been raised by a more progressive mother. Or was it August mother?
August.
Sorry, it was August mother, but like being very close and being sort of like, you know, taught the ways of the world by August's mother. and being very close to August, who has like been outside of the community and is educated. But unfortunately, everyone also speaks kind of like that. So it doesn't necessarily work.
Yeah, I think the weird exception, or not exception, but like when I saw the film, because I had not yet read the book, I was trying to figure out whether like the film placed undue emphasis on August or if I just felt that way because it's Ben Whishaw. And I think it's kind of both. Like there's an inherent problem with casting like one of the generational great actors working today as the character who you're not supposed to pay attention to, while also being the character that has the most source material to draw on because he's the only person in the book that's written vaguely like a person. Mm-hmm. So, like, I was kind of pissed off almost by how affecting I found Ben Whishaw. Like, there were a couple of moments in the film where I teared up and I was super angry about it. And I was like, it's just because it's Ben Whishaw. And I'm angry because I feel emotionally manipulated, which is not his fault, but it is the fault of like the filmmakers for thinking, oh, let's make a movie about women, but then like cast the one actor who could potentially overshadow these women. Don't get me wrong, huge Claire Foy fan. I'm still sort of, I was really into Jesse Buckley. Now I'm kind of like, the jury's not out yet on this.
Well, and also the character of August is almost easier to play well than any of the other characters because he doesn't have the speechifying because he's not supposed to have an opinion.
Yeah.
So he is the most sort of like restrained in the way that he is written because he's not necessarily a mouthpiece. I mean, he does definitely represent something, but he's not a mouthpiece for a specific angle in this battle of ideas in the way that the other characters, the other actors, have to perform an idea.
Yeah,
he also gets to listen without having to kind of come up with a quippy retort, which all of the other characters have to do. Like, he gets moments where he's allowed to kind of sit with things that have been said. And even if those moments are kind of, you know, chintzy at times, at least it's sort of character work for him to play.
Well, and then the sort of function of that is I feel like the film, I mean, the book too, end up kind of really engaging in empathy. Like, theoretically, this is a story about women talking and we're going to actually focus on women. But even the premise is like, if women sit in a room and talk and there isn't a man to record it, did it happen? And
which I think that's an interesting idea to engage with.
Well, if you engage the film, it.
Yeah, I don't think the film does so meaningfully. And it raises all sorts of, right, it raises all sorts of interesting ideas about like how the way that he's recording their story might be skewed towards his perspective, which is maybe you could do some interesting things within the film where you're not literally reading his perspective and you're watching him record these things, but the film wants to make him this very idealized character, and it kind of positions this dichotomy between like him as like the one good man and all the other men in the community as like terrible rapists, and doesn't find any kind of in-between that a lot of men probably do fall into, including probably realistically August, as much as he is a well-meaning person.
That's something I think that's a flaw of both the text and like the book and the film, is that there's no real imagining of what the other men in the community are like. Like, are the eight men who are perpetrating this, are they outliers? Are they ostracized? Are they what all of them are like? What are they like in the daytime? What are they like when they're, you know, going through the rest of their rituals? There's no, like, effort to kind of imagine how this sexual violence that they commit is a part of their lives and a part of the way that they're oriented to the world. And their absence kind of creates a problem of making it seem more aberrant than it probably is.
Yeah, on the other hand, the book does give some more context that makes it a little bit more ambivalent. Like, August report gives us a lot of the context of what's happened. And he reports that basically the men were kind of locked up. I mean, I guess this is in the film too, but that like the men were locked up in the colony, but then women tried to kill them. So then they brought them to town to to protect the men's life is why they're in prison in town, not to protect the women. And every single man in town has been helping to bring bail to get these men out of jail, including August. And August talks about, like, being childhood friends with some of the men that we, like, at least one of the men who's locked up that we know is a perpetrator. And he kind of just shrugs his shoulders like this. He's like, well, we had fun as kids, and I guess he's a rapist now. And then the book also has, like, it does suggest that there are other aberrations, like, because it basically treats August as the embodiment of not all men, and, like, you know, his family was excommunicated. But in the book, there's also, like, a man and his family who, after this happens, or while this stuff is starting to happen, he just uproots his family and leaves the community. There's a lot of resentment towards the community leaders who everybody finds patriarchal, mm-hmm. including men. And so there's a lot more, like, even though I would agree with you that they don't make them really characters, and they're not three-dimensional people where you can kind of, like, understand them and get into, you know, the banality of evil. They're just symbols of evil. At least the book suggests that there are shades and some nuances, which we get from August telling mm-hmm. us these stories. And that gets lost when August is no longer the narrator. And at least in the book, the fact that he's the narrator, I mean, it's kind of problematic that he's positioned as the centerpiece because of the, like, as a text. But then it's weird in the movie because you're like, why do they keep cutting to him?
Yeah.
And without knowing that he was the narrator in the book, it's like, I kind of thought this was the movie about the women talking. Why do we keep needing to see Ben Whishaw reaction shots?
And the movie does go out of its way toward the end to sort of explain why he needs to be the keeper of the notes anyway. But I think there's a textual yeah. reason why in the novel that is kind of absent in the film.
Yeah.
I have a question
yeah.
for those who have read the book. Is the, like, trans subplot in the book, or was that made up for the film?
It's in the book, but it's a bit less explicit. So mm-hmm. the plot is the same, but in the book there's no identifying details really about Nettie/Melvin. So we mm-hmm. find out that Nettie used to call themselves Nettie, then Nettie was raped, now Nettie wants to be called Melvin, though there isn't all this stuff about people misgendering Nettie and that Melvin and that being a conversation. All we know is that now they go by Melvin, and of course August is not enlightened enough to talk about pronouns. And they dress in men's clothes, and they only speak to children. So it's a bit more like it, so that's in the book, and that we own the, like, the big scene with Melvin is when one of the kids sticks a cherry up their nose, and Melvin brings the kid in to the women talking to be like, this is an emergency, you need to deal with it. But there's no information about how Melvin presents or anything. And, like, the movie, if I recall correctly, has this whole discussion around, like, you know, was so traumatized by being raped that, like, Nettie didn't want to be a girl anymore, and so now Nettie's trans or something. Or maybe Melvin mm-hmm. was trans already, and the rape, like, just reinforced that you're never going to really be a man or something like that. And then there's a lot of stuff about the women who keep referring to them as Nettie, whereas in the book they just say Melvin. Sometimes they refer to the character as Nettie Melvin. So it's much less of a, like, it's in there, but it's much less of a like a pointed political statement about people being transphobic and misgendering trans people. It's just sort of yeah. like Melvin is just kind of like a quirky person in the community, which they don't really see as more quirky than the guy who is, they refer to as slow. So I guess this is kind of gross that the connection is with mental illness. But there's like a guy who they let, like, use a tractor and just, like, run around, like, mow around the colony in a tractor, even though no one's allowed to use electric vehicles, and you're like not even to have, allowed to have rubber on your tires for the buggies because you'd move too fast. But they make these exceptions for this guy because they're like trying to help him in a difficult world. So that like there's a lot of stuff about how there are all these exceptions to the rules for men in the colony in the book, but then there are no exceptions to the rules for the women, and that gets totally lost in the film.
Yeah, in the film, the subplot about Melvin, it feels very, first of all, it feels like it's sort of just thrown in there so that they can like acknowledge trans people, and it feels kind of patronizing in the way that they deal with it. I mean, in the film, that like this is presented as like a trans man character essentially, and the idea that that is kind of triggered by a rape feels very not how we necessarily want to talk about trans people. Also the fact that he is a character who like only communicates with children leads to this kind of infantilized image. And then the biggest thing is the fact that this character, who is not also not really a character, just like every character in the film, the big like climax of their story is being correctly named by one of the main women characters.
Yeah.
As almost like a moment to show like her development, but a development that like has not been in any way established or set up or is not in any way meaningful.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, I almost forget about that subplot because it is so disconnected from the rest of the film and could just be lifted right out. But it's something about it just really sat poorly with me, just in like the way that many things about this film and the way it tries to talk about social issues sits poorly with me.
Yeah. I mean, also something that was in that 2019 New York Times piece that I was quoting from before, where they talked to some Mennonites, it actually talks about how, so Taves comes from a Mennonite community called Steinbeck, and in the New York Times article it says Steinbeck has changed since Taves left more than 35 years ago. It's more than doubled in size, opened a liquor store, held a gay pride parade, and built many more churches. So, and it says reception to her books in town has been mixed, locals say. There's not been an outpouring of criticism or anger from the community's elders, but there has definitely not been much celebration or pride that you'd think there would be, said Andrew Unger, a high school English teacher in Steinbeck, who includes Taves' novels in his courses. And he points out that she has not given a reading in town for 15 years. So even in 2019, it was suggesting that, like, Taves was out of touch with what's happened in the Mennonite community. And, like, Sarah Polley had 3 years to correct that and do her research and update it. And she kind of went the other way.
I think to speak to Orla's point, I feel the same about this character. And I think it's, like, it definitely, to me, and maybe Alex, you've read more, like, you've gotten further in the novel than I have, but I'm admitting that I haven't finished the novel.
Struggle.
To me, it feels more pointed. In the film, there's an effort to explicitly characterize Melvin as trans. That is a little bit different. In the novel, it's sort of left at the reading, Orla, that you mentioned, that, you know, the sexual assault somehow transforms Melvin, which is, although that is sort of put in the mouth of Salome. Salome comes to that conclusion that that's what happened. So it's sort of left to us to take with a grain of salt whether that's a correct interpretation or not. We don't actually get Melvin's interpretation of things. But my memory is that the film is more explicit to a clunky degree, right? That it's like, but actually Melvin was always Melvin. Like, okay, but who is Melvin, right? And so, right, like that, it raises.
Melvin was always a blank slate of a character, like, called Melvin.
A kid with short hair in overalls who likes to do farming, which is
and that sort of gets to me, like, a lot of these, the efforts to include marginalized people within the community. I feel like the film, Polly is going out of her way to include such people, to represent them. but the text is so thin about them, and I don't know that she adds anything that's not already there. So, for example, Melvin is the most obvious example, and the correctly being named Melvin and not dead named is kind of the big conclusion to that story in a way that, like, to me, I was like, okay, is this a community that knows what dead naming is or cares about that? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it, to me, it's very similar to the way the disabled characters are depicted. So there's the disabled boy who gets one line. Oh, right? There's a disabled boy who's not treated super well in the novel either. He's discussed as, like, he's going to come along with the women because the disabled people in the community are not fit to be cared for by the men, right? The men are not going to know how to care for them, so they're going to come along with the women if the women leave. He gets one line in the film that I don't know if that's, I don't believe it's in the novel. His one line is, why, when they explain to him that he's going to be leaving. And then there's the girl who is Frances McDormand's character, who is blind, I believe, who, like, a lot of the film hinges on whether she's going to leave or not, even though her mother has decided she's not going to leave. They're not going to participate in the town meeting. And, like, what I mean by, I think Polly is earnestly trying to include these marginalized people, like, she's done the due diligence of casting disabled actors. Both of those characters are played by disabled actors. So, like, checklist has been met, and good for her for doing that. But the text is not interesting, right? Like, there's nothing happening with those characters on the level of, like, giving them anything to do besides as, like, curious cases for them to talk about as, like, entries on their list before the minutes are over. And I think, like, it's another example of, like, putting a Band-Aid on a textual problem that needs to actually be thought about and deepened. And I don't know that that's happened.
And they do in the book, they pretty much, there is a line, I can't remember it exactly, but where it basically says, they say they're, you know, they can't care for themselves. They're basically like children. Which is a pretty offensive thing to say.
And it's fine if they say it, right? Like, it's one thing for characters to be offensive. The question for me is, like, is the, saying anything more interesting than the characters, right? Like, does the novel have any idea about their interiority? Does the film have any idea about their interiority? No,
because in the novel and in the film, depiction becomes endorsement because it doesn't have any kind of commentary on this.
And the way they're written as characters is basically just that, just like as non-characters who follow along with the people who are assigned to care for them and have only said the word why. So, like, in the way they're depicted, it doesn't at all contradict that.
And the one exception, right, is the blind girl deciding to come along. But even that, right, like, the decision is, like, her only expression of character that we see in the film.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, the same is true of August, too, that I'm still not sure whether Taves is making a commentary about how August's thinking is problematic because he was raised in a patriarchal society and hasn't properly learned to question it, or if I'm bringing my own reading to the novel and her depiction is kind of endorsement, because I found his narrator in the book really punchable. like how he won't stop telling us that the women are illiterate, and I don't mean to point out that the women are illiterate, but it's really important that you understand that for the context. Like he says stuff like this all the time, and then, you know, brings in important facts that he learned while in jail, completing his university degree by correspondence, and he's like so condescending in the way he writes those notes, and I'm never really sure if he's, like, intentionally problematic as a way of for Taves to prove the point that, like, even the not all men dude has still absorbed the patriarchy. But I'm not, like, I'm not totally convinced that that's what she's doing, and that she might just have no awareness of that either.
I'm mixed on it, too. I think he's, like, he's kind of an annoying reply guy in some ways. Like, I think he's meant to be a little bit annoying in the book.
I think for sure he's meant to be a little bit annoying.
To what extent he's, like, seen as part of, you know, the same patriarchal culture as the other men, including the ones that he's going to be presumably teaching how to be better men once the women leave, right? They've sort of entrusted him with that job in both the film and the book. I don't know how much the text believes that he's of that same soup and of that same problem as they are.
Well, and you had said that there's some kind of maybe autobiographical portion of August as Tave's father.
Yeah, I know that. I know that there. Tave's father was a teacher and was he also, I think, lobbied to establish the first public library in Steinbeck. So he similarly was, you know, an upstanding member of the community who believed in education and who believed in education as a kind of gateway to a wider world beyond the world they were in. And, you know, presumably was capable of entertaining ideas outside of the faith and outside of the community. And so I think Taves respects that. And she certainly in her novels respects people who, if even if they don't leave these insular communities, they have curiosity about communities outside of them. They're interested in reading. They're interested in going away for a while and becoming rounded before coming back. And so I think there is a kind of natural affiliation with him because of that. But there are moments, I agree, where it does feel like the text is letting us know that he's, if not an unreliable narrator, then a little bit obnoxious at a minimum.
Where to begin with the mess that is how badly this film is directed?
And again, just to clarify, like, we as Seventh Row have been fans of Sarah Polley as a director, like, huge fans. I mean, we put Stories We Tell in our 10 favorite films of the 2010s list.
Yeah.
We like Sarah Polley.
We like her a lot. Yeah. We've been, like, really excitedly anticipating this film.
Yeah. We did a podcast on Take This Waltz as well. We really like that film.
And we think she's made nuanced films about the inner lives of women.
Yes.
That are beautifully made and wonderfully directed. And, like, one of the really bizarre things, which I know a lot of people got stuck on, like, the cinematography of the film and how terrible the lighting is. And
I mean, I think specifically, like, the color grading of the film.
Well, see, the funny thing about that is it's shot, the DP is Luc Montpellier, who is known for colors. Like, if you want your film to be bright and colorful, you hire him. And
did he shoot Take This Waltz?
Yes.
And I'm thinking Take This Waltz is such a strikingly bright and colorful film. Yeah. I think we probably talked about that a lot on the podcast, and this is so much the opposite.
Yeah, it's so competently incompetent that you know it wasn't his choice.
Yes.
Because if he was just incompetent, right, like, occasionally it would look okay.
It's a strange looking film where it is so desaturated to the point of almost being black and white. However, it isn't black and white, and there are a few moments outside in the fields where a little bit of light comes in, and you kind of get the sense that the choice to make it so desaturated was so that you could have, especially at the end, the color kind of seeps back into the film very slightly, and the choice was clearly made to, like, for that contrast. But it's also, I think, the way that it is shot in such a kind of, like, low contrast way makes that low color, almost black and white look very, very drab.
Yeah.
It clearly was a choice, but it was not a well executed choice.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think it was a choice worth whatever effect the end slight burst of color, which is, like, to clarify, not an extreme burst of color, just, like, it raises to the level of, like, almost a normal film at the end.
It's a strange looking film for sure. I forget, someone tweeted that it looked like it was inspired by Polish horror cinema of the past 10 years, and I think that's sort of been ringing in my ears as I've been listening to the conversation about how desaturated it is. I don't know. It's like a big formal gambit that she takes doing that. And I don't, like you were saying, Orla, I don't know that it pays off. And I don't know that it feels like there's an organic purpose for it. And I kind of feel that way about a lot of the aesthetic decisions of the movie. It's a very directed movie, let's say, right? Like, there are a lot of, there's a lot of directing in the movie. The montages are over the top and constant, and every time a different speaker speaks, there's that musical motif that cues up, and it's sort of like the camera slowly pushes into them as they start to speak. There's a real emphasis on these totemic images, both the drawings that are done to illustrate the various decisions to leave, to stay and fight, to do nothing, as well as just like individual images that are focused on and attended to in close-up, like the dentures that one woman has. There's a lot going on aesthetically, and it feels to me kind of similar to like when someone is filming a stage play that they are concerned is going to read too stagey, and so they really sort of crank up the modern, the postmodernism, and the like stylistic attempts to gussy it up, and so like I really feel there's like too much going on here, and it feels like strangely out of place compared to her other adaptations, which are to me feel much more confident and much more secure, and like I have a good read on this good material, and I trust the material to convey itself, and I'm gonna be classical and straightforward. This kind of lacks that confidence, I think, and it sort of feels like more of a calling card first feature than her previous three features do.
Seriously, yeah. Well, also, I mean, it's a film not just a film, but a story, I guess I should say, a text that is kind of like, you could see it as a play because it's effectively, you know, 10 people in a room talking, which is what you think of as a play. And film critics and film people love to talk about how when you direct a play for the screen, you have to quote unquote open it up and find new locations and find ways of making it not stagey. Now, I think a lot of that is hogwash because lots of great directors direct films that aren't plays or based on plays that are in one location, and they aren't boring because they care about the location and because they're about the location and they know how to block. In this film, it would have benefited from some like classical theater direction techniques. Like, for example, levels. You know, one of the things you learn in like intro to theater is about making tableaus. And, you know, some people are on the ground and some people are standing and some people are sitting. And that makes for an aesthetically interesting thing, and that you should place actors in ways and positions that tells you about the relationship between those characters. Like if one is sitting at the feet of the other, then that tells you something. And if they're sitting on the same level, then that tells you something. And if somebody is standing, then that tells you something. And mostly in this film, they're all just kind of like sitting on like wooden blocks. And I couldn't tell you where in the room they're sitting, or I'm still not really sure who belongs, which families belong to which, because you almost never see two actors in the same frame at the same time, unless there's just a random frame of everyone in a disorganized mass. And like, I recognize some of this is maybe a COVID thing, and that they're trying to take precautions and not put people that close together, but like, they must have been all maskless anyway in a tiny room together, so.
Yeah, I don't think that they were, you know, at this stage trying to, like, avoid COVID by, like, having them sit slightly further apart than they might otherwise. The thing about this film is I watched the whole thing, and then at the end there was sort of some kind of wide of the barn that allowed you to see the whole thing.
Oh, really?
My reaction was, oh, is that what it looks like?
Yeah.
Because I realized at that moment that I really had no idea of the geography of the barn, of kind of what it looked like in its full context. And that's because the film and the way that it's directed, like, it just gives you so little idea of, like, the context of the space.
Yeah.
And to not be able to do that in a film that is, like, largely set in one room is a big problem. You know, if people tell you that this film could be a play, then they are cursing you to watch a very boring play.
Well, you know, I think it would work better as a play, because in a play, a room is always a metaphor for something else. Whereas in yes. a film, a room is just a room. And the fact that there's, it's like films that are successfully one location films are films where the location is part of the story. Like, mm-hmm. this is the house that you spent the last 45 years of your life in 45 years, for example. So all mm-hmm. of the details in the house and the production design in that film tell you something about the couple and their relationship and how they're thinking about it. So the location is part of the storytelling. It's not just like we put them in a vacuum. And the problem with the book Women Talking and then the film Women Talking is that they're both designed to be divorced from context. So then when you try and make a film that's like a one location film, like the whole premise is that it's divorced from context. So maybe it would have worked as a play because then the meta theatrical thing would have been that, like, this is a, you know, this isn't a real Mennonite community. It's just a metaphor and, you know, whatever. That would have been problematic in other ways. But in yeah. the movie, it really is just like a room and I don't know what this room looks like. And I still have no idea what's in this community aside from that there seems to be a patch of grass, but also the CGI out of the VFX when you go like look outside of the barn onto the field is so bad that I know the barn was shot in a studio and then I know they went somewhere random and got a field and the field is like maybe the size of a soccer field and to me that is the entirety of this Mennonite community.
But it's true that there are relationships also between the characters in this barn. Like, I think it's several different families and there are mother-daughter relationships in this yeah. barn, for example. And it took me such a long time to get even a slight grasp on the relationship between these people, even though that should be incredibly important. It's almost like the characters just kind of islands talking at each other, but you don't get a sense of their relationship to each other. And you definitely don't get a sense of their relationship to the rest of the community. Because the other question I have is, like, why these women? And what is the implication of, like, these specific women speaking for their entire community? Which is something that the film has, like, zero interest in.
I don't think the book answers that either.
It kind of comes up, mm-hmm. right, that only they decided to show up for this meeting, that others have decided that,
oh, right.
you know, they'll kind of go with what's decided, but they have chores to do. They don't want to rock the boat, but they will accept whatever, you know, the central intelligence of the room decides. So that's kind of as deep as it goes in the book, from what I remember.
And I think in the film, it's explicitly said that these women were chosen. Yeah. as like a committee to discuss this. It's not that anyone else was invited. And it brings up all these questions about, like, what kind of power dynamics does that replicate? And that's not at all explored, because at the end when they make their decision, which definitely not everyone in the community agrees with, because that's evidence through Frances McDormand's character, but it's also like evidence through the fact that they did do a vote and it was very split. Everyone just kind of is like, well, I guess that's a decision we made, and I guess we're uprooting our entire lives, even though we haven't had the chance to process that like these women have. And it's something that could have been so interesting. I mean, there's a lot of things in this film that could have been yeah. so interesting, and are just dropped in favor of a much easier to digest narrative.
Yeah, like, I think the premise of put a bunch of women in a room and have them discuss patriarchy, like, there's a lot of opportunity there. I think that's you could have 50 plays about that where that's the premise and they would be really interesting. But then by forcing it to be a Mennonite community and then not engaging with what it means to be a Mennonite, you know, all of the issues that we talked about, it kind of makes it impossible to do this properly.
It tries to make it as universal as possible in a way to, like, talk about a big concept in a very general way.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's a good way to get an Oscar.
Yeah.
But it's also, at this point, we don't need another story about this kind of stuff that removes all of the specificity of it. Like, it doesn't reveal anything, I don't think.
It's curious that the only people besides McDormand that we see reacting in the negative to the decision are actually the sons, right? One of the sons says basically that he's upset with the decision that's been made on his behalf, and it would be It would be more interesting to hear what the other women in the community have to say, but that's kind of beyond the scope of the structure of either the book or the movie, right? Because they're not in the room, so they don't have a mic to speak. I feel like what, like, I don't know that it feels very Camlet to me outside of, like, mm-hmm. it kind of feels of a piece with the, Zoe Whittall wrote a novel kind of just pre this explosion of Me Too narrative, that the best people we know, is that what it's called? Something like that. That similarly is about...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's like a highly respected male senior member of a community is found guilty of sexual assault, and it sort of ripples throughout the community and through his family. It felt like this text was kind of a piece with that, and is sort of like part of this kind of Camlet doing topical stories of the now. But to me, it feels more like more than Camlet, it's like filmic antecedents, right? Like it's doing 12 yeah. Angry Men, it's doing like Stanley Kramer yeah. message movies more than it's doing Camlet per se.
It's the best kind of people.
There we go. Yeah, thank you. What did I say? The best people we know. I don't know what happened there.
I couldn't remember any film titles today, so you're doing fine.
The other thing it reminded me of, and I know, I think, I was going to say I know she's a fan. I don't know she's a fan, but I think she spoke about it, is that doc, the Canadian doc, A Better Man. That's kind of what some of the Ben Whishaw as the, like, the best possible man we can present and offer up for the community. That's kind of what I was reminded of, and like the conversation about the potential rehabilitation of the young men in the community through him. It felt like that was sort of a text in her mind.
I mean, but at least that documentary, like, the guy is doing the work and he's screwing up, and it's about yeah. how very difficult it is for him, mm-hmm. even at, like, and it creates empathy for him, but it never lets him off the mm-hmm. hook.
Yeah, that's all I got. I mean, there are other Camlet origins you could point to. Like, certainly, like, I think of, like, Margaret Lawrence's novels and Manawaka certainly have, like, women who are victims of abusive men making decisions about leaving or staying and discoursing about it and writing about it. And, like, that's part of the same prairie context. And, like, earlier stuff, like, you can go away, but, like, prairie realism and Ask for Me in My House, but... what's different about this is that, like, this, as we've said, is, like, non-specific, and, like, that Camlet tradition that some people have said Tave's stuff fills into is realist and is centered on regionalism and, like, is very much about depicting what the land looks like and what the traditions of the people who live there are like, and all of that is absent here, right? It's, like, completely yeah. excerpted, it's completely excised from the movie. As well as the novel. Yeah. Anyway, that's just my ramble to say no. I don't think there's a lot of interesting Camlet stuff.
I mean, the one thing for me is both the film and the book kind of had the stench to me of too much hanging out with Margaret Atwood.
Yeah. It's definitely...
Like, it just feels like The Handmaid's Tale and the, like, oh, you know, the act of resistance of writing. Yep. And that like the whole device kind of feels stolen from that. And there are bits and pieces in the novel where I was like, is that a reference to this particular Margaret Atwood poem? Mm-hmm.
And even like Alias Grace, I mean, I know Sarah Pauley has already adapted that, but I feel like their women's quilting is sort of the way that they do. Like here it's women talking in a room, there women quilt as a way of telling their stories of abuse, that like it's a language that other women are able to follow, but the men in the story don't are not able to follow mm. it. This sort of feels like it's doing a version of that in a different discursive field.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are things like that. I think like it certainly got contemporary Camlet, like Atwood and company on its mind, but I don't know that it's doing anything that interesting with it.
But why is a film going to win many Oscars? Which I think is part of the reason, one of the reasons we want to talk about it is yeah. that people really like this film and it's being held up as a example of a great way to discuss these ideas. And I think that every year there's always at least one, if not a few Oscar films that I think follow this pattern of like, we are going to become acclaimed by talking about something social justice related that explores that problem in a way that will
simply
reflect the already held beliefs of the viewer and not challenge them at all. And I think that's absolutely the case here. I think it was the case with something like Promising Young Woman. To be honest, probably the case with something like The Whale this year as well. Only the fact that it's reflecting the already held beliefs of the viewer is it's reflecting the already held incredibly gross beliefs of the viewer.
Well, and the sort of pat yourself on the back that you're not so bad. Like, that happens a lot with movies that deal with racism. You're like, well, at least I didn't call this, you know, I didn't use that racial slur, ergo I am innocent of racism. This film is sort of like, well, we don't live in a society that's as, you know, basic and patriarchal as Mennonites, even though this film is not really interested in Mennonites. And so then you can pat yourself on the back that, you know, at least we have Me Too and I've participated in that. And
I mean, this film is not as bad as Green Book.
Well, no.
but it also has the air of being a bit more intellectual than Green Book. And so it's able to kind of cover up the ways in it, which it is very, very simplistic.
I mean, I think that's where your like comparison to Promising Young Woman is really apt, because we did do an episode on Promising Young Woman and The Assistant, and we talked about this very issue that, like, The Assistant dealt with rape culture in a very subtle way that put you in this woman's headspace of the, you know, million paper cuts of patriarchy and misogyny that she experiences in the workplace every day and becomes complicit in because she has only bad choices available to her. And we, you know, we were like, that movie is brilliant, and that felt visceral, and it made me think, and it felt like it depicted something that no one's talked about before. And then you have Promising Young Woman, which is sort of the most thoughtless approach to this. It's also louder and showier in every way.
And more satisfying than The Assistant.
Well, yeah, because there's somebody gets a comeuppance. But it's also like, it's a movie that's like, look, I'm here directing. Look, I am here acting. Unlike The Assistant, which was, you know, very naturalistic. And, you know, as Angelo points out about women talking, it certainly has been directed. So there's like a sort of, you know, it's sort of like Sound of Metal. It was like, oh, I now know what sound design is because the film explained it to me in every scene. It's kind of like it's talking down to the audience enough so you don't have to think at all. And then it has the cathartic, we get to leave it and find a better society. / also pat ourselves on the back for already being in that society, maybe.
Well, and I think it was a two sort of quote unquote post Me Too films that are in the Oscar conversation this year, this film and She Said, which also seen.
Yeah.
And ironically, both produced by Brad Pitt's production company.
Bad timing.
So that's just
bad timing.
I did when the Plan B logo showed up at the beginning of Women Talking, I felt a moment of like, this is awkward. And I was like, do the other people in the cinema feel that? Because I feel like they should, but
do you want to explain for the audience, especially if somebody listens to this in 2 years and is like, when was this recorded?
Yeah, I mean, there's currently a lot of ongoing, I guess, legal disputes about whether, Brad Pitt was abusive in his relationship with Angelina Jolie, and there is a restraining order out against between him and his children. So that's currently a thing that I suppose is still being litigated in public discourse. So if you are listening in a few more years, that might be more widely known, and I feel like it's becoming more widely known at the moment. So that's a conversation we're having right now. And this is a very strange time to be having it, given that he has produced the films called Women Talking and She Said. But yeah, so She Said is a film that is actually explicitly about Me Too, in the sense that it is about the two journalists who uncovered the Weinstein story and did the first published reporting on it. and I don't think it necessarily missteps as frequently or in the same way as Women Talking does. I think it's a better film. I don't think it's a particularly good film. It's very kind of just like process focused, but it also feels very stagey in the way they do reenactments of these conversations. I've read the book that it's based on. I found the book very compelling. It's written by the two journalists. And the thing about the film is, well, the thing about the book is that the book ends, I mean, the book, the actual like publishing of the story happens about halfway through the book. And then the second half of the book talks a lot about like the aftermath of publishing the story. It then goes on to talk about the whole like Brett Kavanaugh thing with Christine Blasey Ford, which the same journalist also reported on. And then it has a roundtable discussion with the women who spoke out about Weinstein and like transcribes that conversation about them sort of talking about like everything that happened after that story was reported. So the book kind of does grapple a bit with like, okay, so this big breakthrough happened, but to what extent has the culture changed afterwards and what impact has that reporting had? And it's a bit more of a interesting and nuanced conversation about that. And the book, the film ends the moment they hit publish on the story. Like literally they press publish and then the film is over. And it really frustrated me because it sort of felt like the film wanted to be like an exact document of like this reporting and then to end at the moment that can feel the most triumphant, like simplistically triumphant. And it didn't want to have any of the more complex conversations about like what our society looks like today after this reporting happened and whether things changed as much as we might want them to have changed. And the fact that the film was produced by Brad Pitt's production company might imply that maybe it hasn't changed quite as much as we might like to think that it has. But they both, they're interesting in conversation with each other, Women Talking, and She Said, just because I feel like they want to, they want to take very difficult things and make them as like affirming to the audience's worldview as possible and as sort of feel good as you can make a film about women being assaulted at the end. And it just feels so kind of, yeah, uninteresting to me because it's not like pushing us to have conversations we might be more uncomfortable with.
And do you feel that that's the same thing with Women Talking? Is it's not actually generating conversation? It's just kind of like, well, now we've reflecting conversation, but not asking people to think of about how to progress that or how to.
Yeah, well, I think that it is writing dialogue that the audience can nod along to and agree with in pursuit of like an end decision by these women. That is the decision that we as the audience want them to take and would probably take ourselves. And we could be like, yes, that was the correct decision. Leave the men behind. And they come to it in a manner that we would expect. And it feels just like a mirror of the conversations of people who feel themselves to be enlightened about patriarchy. And not anything more than that to me, to be honest. And so I think it makes people feel good about themselves and it does end on a moment of kind of triumph almost. Like, again, the color seeps back into the film. It feels like a statement on like, and the future will be better from here. And it doesn't necessarily complicate that.
Even though they don't know where they're going and they've never had to do their own farming and...
And are they not walking into a world that is also patriarchal?
Yeah, exactly.
I would just piggyback onto what Orla is saying, that I think part of the appeal is that ending, that this that suggests they're going out to give birth to this utopian democracy, right? They're going to remake the world in this no place just beyond the barn, just beyond the community they're coming from. And we get to see, we get to be in on the ground floor of the decision-making process, the list-making of like, what do we want in our utopia? how do we want to organize it? And so I think there's something appealing about that. There's something appealing about, like, a bunch of actresses that we like being the de facto leaders of that new world organization. There's something appealing even about the specter of the, like, Manifest Destiny plot. Like, that's kind of there, right? Like, it's not explicitly stated, right, that there's something icky about moving out into the world and just claiming a new land as your own. But that is a kind of fantasy that the end of the novel is selling. And it's selling it as a kind of feminist recouping of territory that was previously patriarchal, right? But the lack of politics is part of the fantasy, right? The lack of any kind of colonial complication is part of the fantasy that that ending is selling. And it's also selling it all through the figure of Ona's child, right, to whom the story is presumably dedicated, which is one of the changes from the book to the film, right, that there's this effort to kind of pitch the whole thing as a text that is being inherited by the next generation who's going to be doing things differently and doing things better. I think that's part of the pitch of the film, and that's part of why it's resonating with people.
Although it is kind of weird, because how does her daughter have that if the text stays with August and the colony and she...
He photocopied it before they left.
Oh, right.
He airdropped it to Ona's child.
There we go.
Thank you so much for listening. Here's where you can find myself, Alex, and Angelo.
So, Angelo, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at amuredda, which is A-M-U-R-E-D-D-A, where I am talking about movies, talking about higher ed, talking about public transit, and all sorts of things that annoy me.
And you're writing at Film Freak Central and CinemaScope.
Yeah.
Mostly?
Yeah. I'm going to have a piece and I'm going to have a review of Armageddon Time coming up soon for Film Freak Central, possibly out by the time this is out. And I'm going to be...
Yeah, that'll be like 2 months ago by the time this is out.
And I'll be writing something for CinemaScope about the Halloween movies and their various endings and the many deaths of Michael Myers, the many deaths and rebirths of Michael Myers.
Orla, where can people find you?
You can find me at OrlaMango on Twitter, and you can find my writing at Seventh Row and me on this podcast.
You can find me, Alex Heaney, on Twitter at BWestCineast, BWESTCINEASTE. You can also find me on my writing on Seventh Row and on this podcast, and you can find all of us talking about breaking down colonial narratives and the problem with Manifest Destiny in our book on Kelly Reichardt, Roads to Nowhere. ReichardtBook.com.
We've talked in more positive spirits about Sarah Polley's work in past podcast episodes, which are now members only. In episode 40, we chat about stories we tell. And in episode 43, we chat about Take This Waltz. I also really recommend episode 73, which we touch on in this episode. It discusses the differing depictions of rape culture in The Assistant and Promising Young Women. And I think that's very relevant to the kinds of things that we've been talking about today. You can become a member at 7th-row.com/join. This episode is a free taster for non-members, but typically bonus episodes that cover new releases like this one are members only. If you want to catch our next bonus episode about the best films of 2022, as well as all our past episodes, that link once again is 7th-row.com/join. If you enjoyed this episode, we would love for you to let us know. You can email us at contact@7th-row.com or tweet at us all at 7th Row. But the best way to tell us what you think of the pod is by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a ton and always makes our day. We see you next time.